Please remember to watch your language.
Look, I can't speak without swearing, and I've only got my grade 10, and I haven't had a cigarette since I've been arrested, and I'm ready to f***ing snap. So I'd like to make a request under the People's Freedom of Choices and Voices Act that I be able to smoke and swear in your courtroom. Because if I can't smoke and swear, I'm f***ed.
The following programming may contain content that some listeners find offensive. If you are sensitive to foul language or explicit content, please turn your radio the f*** off now.
It's the TV Philosophy edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, a TV lineup of philosophy as seen in TV shows like South Park, Star Trek, and games like Fallout and more. Let's begin episode 259.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are away from the cosmos to know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Dawn, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. Let's start this week off with a dose of philosophy as experienced via Star Trek.
Today we're boldly going where lots of people have gone before. We're talking about Star Trek. And before you all have a collective shit fit, we're mostly focusing on the Star Trek reboot. Not because it's better, but because there's just way too much original Star Trek to cover in one episode. Anyway, the original Star Trek and its subsequent 8 billion spin-offs follow the adventures of the Starship Enterprise as it explored the depths of the Milky Way galaxy. Set roughly 400 years into the future from its 1966 air date, Star Trek was a radical imagining of the future. One where humanity's prized starship is manned by a Russian, a Japanese-American, a black woman, an interracial alien, and this guy.
I'm Captain Kirk!
The original Star Trek was based in humanism, a philosophy that is characterized by a profound faith in the innate goodness of humans and their ability to be rational. For creator Gene Roddenberry, humanity may well have a few growing pains, but will eventually grow up to be a responsible civilization without war or poverty. Part of this utopian vision of the future was an unapologetic stance towards cosmopolitanism. Not only did the show unite disparate races and nationalities on the bridge of the Enterprise, like including a Russian as part of the crew during the height of the Cold War, but the Wild West of space served as a backdrop to play out morality tales, focusing on the dangers of ruthless dogmatism, foreign intervention, and racism. Even humanity's history is frequently maligned, with constant references to the numerous and pointless wars of the 20th century, and the tendency for us as a species to act like a bunch of petulant children armed with nuclear weapons. But if the original Star Trek was about embracing cosmopolitanism, the new J.J. Abrams version is about reacting to the ramifications of that world. The J.J. Abrams Star Trek takes place in an alternate timeline that's created when an elder Spock tries to stop a supernova that's threatening to destroy the entire galaxy before it reaches the Romulan homeworld. It doesn't really make sense, so don't bother. Spock fails to save Romulus in time, but does eventually create a black hole to consume the supernova, which hurdles him and a revenge-driven Eric Bana back in time. The old Star Trek used to ask really hard moral questions, like, how can we put aside personal hatred with an enemy civilization for the greater good?
Don't trust them!
They're dying.
Or should we interfere in the natural development of a civilization? New Star Treks, however, are about interstellar temper tantrums and space terrorists in the spirit of our modern political climate. Nero, who blames the Vulcans for the death of his planet, gets all genocidal with a weapon of mass destruction. And Khan, in the ultimate act of friendship, has a guy blow up a research facility and goes on a killing spree. In other words, if the older Star Treks imagined the promise of a united humanity and its technological advancements, the new Star Treks imagine how scary all of that sounds. Miners who can drill holes into planets, fuel sources that can devour civilizations, time travel that still can't bring back William Shatner? No thanks, science. But let's not get too grumpy. Behind all the nerd rage-inducing nonsense, there is something to be learned. One carryover through the original series is the famous Spock phrase,
"The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few."
For most, this is a pretty uncontroversial position. It's also one of the basic premises of utilitarianism, a philosophy promoted by English philosopher Jeremy Bentham that promoted behavior to bring the greatest amount of happiness to the greatest amount of people. Bentham, of course, turned his back on this principle when he decided to mummify his own body, thus providing nightmare fuel for centuries of humans to come. Oh, God. But I digress. Spock is more or less a utilitarian.
A sentient being's optimal chance at maximizing their utility is a long and prosperous life.
In fact, in Star Trek Into Darkness, the film goes to great lengths to show you what a dick move the alternative is. A guy murders a building full of innocent people to save his daughter, Khan will do all sorts of murdering to save his fellow superhumans, and even Nero in Star Trek will try to exterminate the entire Federation in hopes of averting the loss of the Romulan people. But despite these cinematic instances of black and white morality, there are a lot of arguments that throw this idea into question, even if Spock claims it's only logical.
It's logical.
Philosophers love to argue about the trolley problem. If you're unfamiliar, it's a thought experiment where you find yourself about to witness a group of people get mowed down by a train barreling towards them. Luckily for the thought experiment, you're in reach of a lever that can divert the train to another track. On that track is just one person. Do you pull the lever, thus killing one person to save multiple? Many would pull the lever, but it still feels icky. You've decided that the needs of many outweigh the needs of the few, but then again, now it's directly your fault that someone is dead. Other versions of the trolley problem complicate this decision further, but in a much more uncomfortable way. Would you push a fat dude on the track because he's sufficiently large to slow down the train and allow the group to escape? What if Fatty was a cancer researcher? What if the group of people you're saving was actually the cast of The Big Bang Theory? The variations, as you may have guessed, continue ad nauseum. Determining the good of the many over the few, it turns out, is really hard. If pulling the lever is permissible, what about killing someone to donate their organs to five people in need? In Star Trek, we see a different thought experiment, a simulation in which a captain is forced to die trying to save a stranded crew of civilians, or give up and look like an asshole. The Kobayashi Maru, as it appears to cadets, poses a dilemma similar to the trolley problem. Can you justify sacrificing your crew in the hopes of saving a ship of civilians? As it's later revealed, failure is inevitable in the Kobayashi Maru. It's a rigged game. By doing this, the simulation shifts a lesson about ethics into a lesson about human fallibility and accepting no-win scenarios. In other words, it's a trolley problem where everybody dies every time. Rather than try to offer a moral solution to either problem, the film finds its answer in Captain Kirk, who just cheats.
I don't believe in no-win scenarios.
But in good storytelling fashion, this avoidance comes to bite Kirk in the ass when he encounters a real no-win scenario. In The Wrath of Khan, he loses his best friend.
I have been, and always shall be, your friend.
And in Into Darkness, he sacrifices himself. So, what's the lesson here? If your answer is the needs of many outweigh the needs of the few, well then, hold on a second. Because the other premise of the Khan storyline is that utilitarianism, you know, that needs of the many idea, is kind of what bred tyrannical Khan in the first place. While Khan was a dictator who robbed people of freedom, he also managed to eliminate war under his reign.
We offered the world order.
Does saving hundreds of thousands of lives from the devastation of war justify the loss of freedom, especially when only a handful of whiners are actually missing it? Star Trek, in one moment, will preach the merits of being human and all the value we ascribe to institutions like friendship and family, and in another moment, will show us people murdering other people for the sake of friendship and family. The same could also be said about the purely logical alternative. While Spock is celebrated for his cold logic,
fascinating.
Plenty of Star Trek episodes show just how stupid cold logic can be. That's one of the great things about Star Trek. Instead of strongly espousing one philosophy, it dives headfirst into moral ambiguity. German philosopher Hannah Arendt warns of the dangers of pure utilitarian thought. As she says, the crimes against human rights can always be justified by the pretext that right is equivalent to being good or useful for the whole in distinction to its parts. This predicament is by no means solved if the unit for which the good for applies is as large as mankind itself, for it is quite conceivable that one fine day, a highly organized and mechanized humanity will conclude quite democratically.
The line must be drawn here.
Despite Spock's assertion that the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, Star Trek as a series is critical of such easy answers. Like Arendt, the show often warned against the dangers of pure utilitarian thought. In the Next Generation series, for instance, the most powerful and frightening enemy of the Federation is the Borg, a cybernetic hive mind that perfectly illustrates why Arendt was convinced that a highly organized and mechanized humanity was such a frightening prospect.
We are the Borg. Lower your shields and surrender your ships. We will add your biological and technological distinctiveness to our own. Your culture will adapt to service us. Resistance is futile.
What makes the Borg so terrifying is how, with a cold utilitarian logic, the collective excludes the needs of the few as it works out the most efficient way to serve the needs of all. According to a purely utilitarian argument, Nero might have been a stand-up guy. You could argue that, had Vulcan never existed, the Romulans would have never placed their faith in Spock. A strong Romulan Empire without the interference of Vulcan might have been able to avert the disaster, and boom, genocide justified.
To create Romulus exists. Free of the Federation.
If Romulus is a planet with 18 billion people, as some Star Trek sources suggest, and Vulcan is a planet of 6 billion people, then why not? Thankfully, Star Trek subtly answers this question. If you look at Star Trek Into Darkness, it opens with two explosions, one to save a civilization, the other to save a child. In every utilitarian decision made by Spock and Kirk in both Into Darkness and The Wrath of Khan, the sacrificing of one for the many is always a personal choice. The 2009 Star Trek even begins with Kirk's father piloting his ship on a crash course so that his crew, wife, and child can escape. And this neatly avoids Hannah Arendt's warnings of the dangers of pure mechanistic utilitarianism. If you want to sacrifice one life for many, sacrifice your own fucking life.
It's time to beam me up, Scotty, and take a pause as we return after this break.
Support for CITR comes from Golden Voiced, welcoming Icelandic trio Sigur Rós on their 2016 North American tour on Sunday, September 18th at the Queen Elizabeth Theatre. Sigur Rós tickets are on sale now at Ticketmaster.ca.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on CITR 101.9 FM. Your Federation-approved skeptical radio podcast. And we're back. From Star Trek to Fallout, what's the hidden philosophy this game is promoting? Let's listen in and find out.
Fallout. Let's set the scene.
What is this Fallout, anyhow?
The Fallout series takes place around the 23rd century, in an alternate reality where the culture of the 1950s just wouldn't die, but most of humanity does. In this world, the Cold War mentality was prevalent right until the bitter end. After nations began to run out of oil in the 2050s, the world plunged into a global conflict that ended in 2077 when the then nuclear powers decided to launch their arsenals at each other, enveloping the world in a new dark age. Apocalyptic fiction is a goldmine of philosophical analysis, and Fallout is no different. Welcome to this special episode on the philosophy of Fallout. In our first section, we'll be talking about how society, culture, and propaganda can convince us to do really, really stupid things. Okay, so we know that a nuclear war completely devastated Earth, but one of the more fascinating questions is how did it get there? In the alternate reality, fascination with atomic power proliferated during the mid-20th century and was never offset by the invention of the transistor. You know, those little electrical parts that led to the radio, computer, and the smartphone you're probably watching this video on. As a result, the pre-war society of Fallout is technologically advanced like our own, but in a slightly different way. Technology is big and bulky, and the computers are primitive compared to our own. On the other hand, they have badass power armor and laser guns, so society as a whole probably didn't miss the advent of Minecraft that much. The Wasteland, the general term for the nightmare landscape that pervades the game, is filled with reminders of the sheer optimism of the pre-war world. It was an age of atomic energy where our greatest dreams could be accomplished with a little ingenuity and maybe a few giant anti-communist death robots.
Death is a preferable alternative to communism.
Nowhere is this optimism more apparent than in the vaults themselves. Even when nuclear annihilation seems imminent, the remnant vault posters maintain a certain cheeriness. Now, let's ignore the fact that many of the vaults were really just a cover for the government to concoct insane experiments on its residents.
Gary!
The vaults are a testament to the human power of cognitive dissonance. The possibility of being locked in an underground bunker for an indeterminate amount of time is advertised as an exciting foray, where you can meet new friends and raise a family. The vaults are a callback to the luxury bomb shelters of the Cold War era. Yes, they really existed. These mental gymnastics were taken up by German-American philosopher Herbert Marcuse during the height of the Cold War. He argued that these pleasant appearances plastered over modern-day nightmares were a testament to the ability of modern society to destroy criticism.
You know how bad sunburn can feel. The atomic bomb flash could burn you worse than a terrible sunburn.
In other words, capitalism is just so damn good at marketing, it makes even the worst shit in the world just seem dandy. He even cites the real-life deluxe fallout shelter, replete with televisions, lounge chairs, and Scrabble boards, as the ultimate example of the obscene merger between appearance and reality, between a cozy luxury getaway and a situation that unilaterally sucks balls. This disparity between appearance and reality is what drives the humor of Fallout. We are constantly confronted with contrary images, the quaint and cheery Leave It to Beaver-esque culture and the hellscape it's set in. In addition to the vaults, this can be observed in the game's radio stations that serenade the wasteland with chipper jazz tunes as the player fends off crazed irradiated remnants of the human race.
Hello, Capital Wasteland!
The use of the song I Don't Want to Set the World on Fire, used prominently in the game's trailer, plays off the song's innocent romanticism with the imagery of the burnt-out remains of Washington, D.C. And, you know, the world was literally set on fire. Other songs, like Cole Porter's upbeat Anything Goes, a song about lax morals of modern society, is a nod to the absolute anarchy of the wasteland, where in addition to exposed women's stockings, cannibalism is also fair game. These marriages between positive and negative, happy and sad, dream and nightmare, aren't just comedic. It's the mechanism in which we as a society are constantly celebrating the same culture and technology that consistently puts us at the brink of total annihilation. We may laugh at this ironic play of elements, but we can also view it as a criticism of government propaganda. Marcuse argued that we are living in an age of one-dimensional thought, enabled by the merging of positive and negative, where rationality and technology can only go one way, forward. In other words, we are told that technology is always good, always. So while society is free to debate the best way to bring order to the wasteland or kill communists,
democracy is truth, communism is a lie.
There's no room for negative thought or ideas that undermine the one-dimensional, inane positivity of society. This is perhaps most clear at the beginning of Fallout 3, where the player is literally trapped at their own birthday party until they have a sufficient amount of fun. Another component of making everyone a-okay with our twisted reality is simply by making them too happy to care. This leads us to the Enclave. The Enclave is what's left of the United States government that want to purge the wasteland of, well, everybody. We learn that John Henry Eden, the president of the United States, is a computer.
Ah, face to face at last.
As if an actual computer trying to kill everybody wasn't enough to demonstrate the dangers of one-dimensional thinking, Eden understands the importance of fun and leisure in an obedient society. In one of his radio addresses to the wasteland, Eden praises the virtue of baseball as some savior to the American dream.
I am referring, of course, to our great national pastime, baseball. That's right, America. Before we were devastated by atomic war, each state had its own professional baseball team. Their purpose? To make you, dear America, revel in the joys of sport and sunshine. Put your faith in John Henry Eden, great America, and baseball will live again.
The comfort and recreation that John Henry Eden is trying to revive are hallmarks of the pre-war society. The wasteland is littered with reminders of our own excess. Leisure suits, magazines, televisions. We're even confronted with a gang that mistakenly thinks that Elvis Presley is some kind of deity.
In Freeside, the kings rule. And the king rules the kings, got it?
These comforts provide us an easy way to cope with the horrific reality around us. Eden is trying to resurrect the same kind of distracted society that got us in this mess in the first place. A society that probably wouldn't mind if he tried to kill them all, because, well, he's totally trying to do that too. From the Great War that decimated the world to the secret government experiments that created the super mutants that are now trying to kill you, we're constantly reminded of technology run amok. In Fallout, as in real life, technology is a double-edged sword, both good guy and bad guy. So when we as players are confronted with choices about technology, the game presents us with a series of moral dilemmas. Should technology be used to provide clean water for the people of the wasteland, or unleash a devastating virus to purify it of its violence and corruption? Who should gain control of Mr. House's robotic army in the battle over the fate of New Vegas? These questions, for the thoughtful player, can be quite troublesome. The idea that humans can't handle technology is really old. Fallout draws inspiration from the Greek myth of Phaethon, the son of the sun god Helios. Phaethon, being the brash child he was, decided to take his dad's ride for a spin. But unlike your dad's Porsche,
Porsche, there is no substitute.
Helios's ride was a chariot that carried the actual sun across the sky. It went exactly as you'd expect, with Phaethon pretty much ruining everything, and burning up a huge portion of the Earth. In New Vegas, the giant solar plant capable of harnessing, pun intended, the sun's energy is called Helios 1, and like Sun God Jr., the player can gleefully take the sun's destructive power for a joyride and slaughter thousands of NCR soldiers. One response to this technological dilemma is the Brotherhood of Steel, the secretive order of power armor-clad badasses who roam the wasteland looking for long-lost technology. Like post-apocalyptic hoarders, the Brotherhood stashes their technology in heavily armored bases to make sure that it doesn't fall into the wrong hands. The wrong hands, of course, being anybody but them. The Brotherhood is so insistent that nobody can be trusted with technology but themselves that they will go to war with any faction possessing advanced tech. Perhaps the Brotherhood is right that we can't be trusted with technology. But if so, it's probably also true that they shouldn't be trusted either. The other response to technology is seen in Caesar's Legion, who swears off technology except the kind that enables its user to kill better. But unlike the Brotherhood, who thinks technology is inherently dangerous, Caesar believes that technology makes people weak and dependent. Even without technology, Caesar's Legion manages to do plenty of wrongdoing. The brutal totalitarian state doesn't need supercomputers or power armor to make everyone's life a living hell. So maybe technology isn't to blame after all. The citizens of the wasteland come together to create various forms of government, from cruel tyranny-fueled slavery, to liberal democracies, to, whatever this is. Aside from illustrating political theories from the days of yore, Fallout also does a pretty good job of explaining modern theories about international relations. In New Vegas, Caesar wants to unite all of humanity under his banner in a dystopian nightmare where everyone is a slave and Roman cosplayer. While Caesar's Legion is superficially modeled after the Roman Empire, the actual foreign policy of Caesar is alive and well today. Caesar thinks that peace comes through security and doesn't believe that peace is attainable until his Legion is the only dominant faction in the wasteland. If not the only faction at all. In international relations, we call this the hegemonic stability theory, which believes that superpowers scare the living hell out of everyone else, and they all, for the most part, behave. To an extent, it works in the game. Traders prefer to trade in Legion territory because it's safer, raiders have been eliminated, and everyone is terrified to break the law. Traders in NCR territory, however, always have to be on alert for raiders and other small factions. Every faction in Fallout is essentially trying to become the local hegemon, the international equivalent of the playground bully, by putting other factions in their place and vying for power. And it goes without saying that if Caesar eliminated the NCR and other factions, there would be some sort of peace in the wasteland. If you're not looking to enslave the whole world, there are other options available. In many situations, a balance of power among factions makes war too costly. If the NCR hadn't invaded New Vegas to annex it, it's not because they're a bunch of outstanding citizens, but because the cost would simply be too high. The boomers understand this, and like a post-apocalyptic Switzerland, have only managed to stay out of everyone's business by protecting their borders with a constant barrage of artillery fire. For those who ascribe to a realist model of international relations, each faction or state is only out to save their own hide, and power is a zero-sum game. The only way to ensure security is to make sure you have more vertebrates than the next guy. Peace is only achieved by uncertain ceasefires between, say, the NCR and the Enclave. Alliances are fleeting and only exist to combat more powerful and dangerous factions. Now, whether or not this works is debatable. Even in the real world, lots of wars are fought over who gets to be in charge. America! It precludes the ability of factions to work together and truly trust each other, and isn't that what launched us into a nuclear holocaust in the first place? The stakes of diplomatic relations in Fallout are always really high, namely because every single issue is caught in a life and death struggle for the soul of humanity. But how far are you willing to go to maintain your security? Should the NCR resort to bullying, tolerate corruption, and make alliances with not-so-scrupulous figures to maintain peace and expand their power, all in the name of democracy? In Fallout 3, how far will you go to bring clean water to the wasteland? Should you, as a player, murder every obstacle, or seek the diplomatic approach? Assuming you haven't decided to play the game in the most evil way possible, many make a choice to support whoever is right. Maybe you believe that the NCR, while flawed, is the kind of democracy that the world needs, or maybe you think technology needs to be taken away from the irresponsible actors who possess it. The problem with security logic, according to some philosophers, is its totalizing logic. Daniel Callahan argues that there is no limit in the amount of terrible, grotesque things we are willing to do in the name of survival. Or in the words of old Ben Franklin, those who surrender freedom for security will not have, nor do they deserve, either one. The point is not lost on Enclave President John Henry Eden, who declares on the radio,
"The question has been raised, I know, as to just how I came to be elected. Fortunately, in the interest of national security, I'm not at liberty to discuss the details of the election."
The Enclave will go so far to save the real humanity that they will exterminate all the mutated riffraff that threatens them. A similar despotism is seen in New Vegas, though a little less genocidal. If you work for Mr. House in New Vegas until the conclusion, you'll trigger an ending that looks like this.
"Mr. House continued to run New Vegas his way, a despotic vision of pre-war glory. The streets were orderly, efficient, cold."
In other words, the chaos of the wasteland could be tamed after all, but only at the expense of personal freedoms and democracy. Mr. House is explicit in his distaste for freedom, saying,
"Nothing to impede progress. If you want to see the fate of democracies, look out the windows. But autocracy? Firm control in the hands of a technological and economic visionary? Yes, that Vegas shall have."
In actual history, we see security as a constant theme among dictators. Crises are manufactured and threats exaggerated to justify more police and more repressive laws. In the world of Fallout, there are no shortages of these crises to exploit. One of the most fascinating elements of the Fallout series is its constant interrogation of human society and government. The game's refrain that war never changes might as well say humanity never changes. After all, aside from the feral ghouls and super mutants, the scariest part of the wasteland is a rehashing of our own regrettable history: slavery-obsessed Romans, Orwellian dictatorships, and genocidal governments. History, it seems, does repeat itself.
And one fallout is we need to take another break. Hear you soon.
Hey there.
Barev.
We're the Armenian Students Association, and we're here to bring together everyone,
Armenians and non-Armenians,
who are interested in learning about the Armenian culture here at UBC.
Find us on Facebook at ASAUBC to stay up to date. We look forward to seeing you at our future events.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on 101.9 FM Vancouver, Canada, a subsidiary of Voltec Industries. And we're back. From Fallout to South Park, what is the philosophical messages between Trey and Matt's South Park? Let's listen and learn.
Today we're talking about a show that's at the top of its game after almost 20 years on the air, South Park, specifically season 19.
Woo, woo, woo! You hear that? That's the sound of 2015 pulling you over, people. Suck it!
Unlike much earlier seasons, season 19 is a serialized narrative that tells an overarching story from episode to episode. They played with this idea a bit in season 18, but overall, it wasn't nearly as comprehensive. Season 19 is arguably their smartest season yet. It chronicles the small Colorado town as it experiences significant social changes, introduces a new central character, and comments on America's current political climate.
You've got a gaping gash, and you've got vinegary bowels.
One of the cleverest aspects of this season is its layered commentary.
Looks like
things are getting all PC again.
Not only is it about our modern social condition, but also about the show itself. The season opens with the firing of Principal Victoria over an incident referring to rape as a hot Cosby.
A new person has been appointed to try and make South Park Elementary a more progressive place that fits in with today's times.
He might as well be talking about South Park the show.
I'm here because this place is lost in a time warp.
In other words, can South Park's signature vulgar sensibility possibly survive in our current politically correct world? You could go through the season and interpret these comments on the town changing as a meta-commentary on the show itself facing change.
This town is changing so fast. Everybody want to be PC, be updated. It's like I'm a relic.
The mayor later makes this explicit to Officer Barb Brady.
You're from another time, Barb Brady. And the last thing that needs to go.
The newsmen are constantly droning on about noticing changes to the town, and Mr. Garrison, himself a fountain of unbridled profanity, returns to South Park to save it from these changes.
What the Sam hell is going on?
But what's the deal with the PC plotline? One might be satisfied with the explanation that it's Trey Parker and Matt Stone taking a dump on liberal politics as they've done in the past. The two have espoused their libertarian leanings in interviews before, but they often evade a simple left-right divide. If you felt slightly lost in this connection between ads, PC culture, and gentrification, you're not alone. But find solace because we've got an idea, and it all starts with neoliberalism.
We would like to give you $26 million.
Welcome to this Wisecrack edition on the philosophy of South Park, Season 19. Part 1, PC culture, gentrification, and ads. In a nutshell, neoliberalism is an economic ideology that stresses personal freedoms and market solutions to address society's problems. Want to fix healthcare, the post office, or Chipotle? Let the market take care of it. Or as philosopher Henry Giroux puts it, the tenets of neoliberalism are 1. Consumerism is the most important duty as a citizen, 2. Individual freedoms trump public freedoms, and 3. All public social issues are addressed on a private level. Neoliberalism neatly ties together three seemingly disparate themes in the show: gentrification, PC culture, and advertising. Which leads us to one of the best lines of the season.
What is PC but a verbal form of gentrification? Spruce everything up, get rid of all the ugliness, in order to create a false sense of paradise? Only one thing can actually live in that world. Ads.
Neoliberalism has one goal: make everything marketable. Gentrification, for example, is the free market's way of dealing with shitty neighborhoods.
What are you people doing?
We're gentrifying! It's all good!
It's the process whereby real estate developers and business interests take advantage of low prices and industrial chic to sell white people overpriced tapas without fixing the underlying problem of poverty. Even diversity and multiculturalism serve the engines of profit. Want to venture to Shittipa Town to experience exotic cuisines of other cultures? Well, don't feel too dignified in your worldliness by suggesting that advertisers are manipulating PC culture in order to gentrify rundown areas all over the world. The show playfully points to something that they've been saying for years, that in a neoliberal economy, otherness and diversity have just become marketable brands in order to sell anything and everything. This is all made pretty explicit in the show.
Oh, great. So now ads are using PC for their own gains? That's a new low.
One might say that the ads are a stand-in for the grossly inhuman forces of neoliberal capitalism.
And now, the ads have taken the next step in their evolution. They have taken human form.
Ready to assimilate or destroy everything and everyone in its path, but always behind the scenes and barely noticeable. Leslie and PC principals stir up an anxiety. What if my friend, family, or beloved TV shows are just ads or sponsored content? What if I'm an ad?
What the hell's going on, bro?
In a world permeated by advertising, how can we know what ideas are truly our own, rather than planted by clever commercials? What makes the ads so dangerous is their ability to cover up the reality of the situation, to distract us. In the end, as Nathan says, it's only ads that can live in this world. Reduced versions of ourselves, of cultures, that can be neatly packaged and sold. Cultures of social acceptance that are more of a brand than actual tolerance. Gay pride parades sponsored by TD Bank, or real standards of beauty sponsored by Dove. Because who needs real revolution when there's a clever hashtag? Now, we're not arguing that diversity is bad, and neither is South Park. But one thing neoliberalism is really good at is a process called co-optation, to take what was once outside of the system and assimilate it so that it can serve the needs of capitalism. Neoliberalism absorbs identities and diversity so that multiculturalism becomes a trendy brand to be purchased.
Is there a reason the children with disabilities and black child are front and center?
Oh no, that's just where they always sit, next to our beloved Craig there, who is a homosexual.
For the town of South Park to advance economically, they have to adopt these marks of tolerance to bring in businesses and new residents. So, how do you convince the world that your town isn't some antiquated backwater shithole, but rather a bastion of progressive ideals? Whole Foods. The show uses Whole Foods as a focal point for a ton of the progressive changes happening.
Our town has only had a Whole Foods for 3 weeks and we already have our first gay kids. So cool.
When the town thinks Craig and Tweak are gay, Whole Foods serves as the setting where everyone congratulates Craig's dad on the news. Randy even credits Whole Foods for their new police-free environment.
We've only had a Whole Foods for a month and already we don't need cops. So cool.
Whole Foods has ceased to be a place where we can buy organic food and instead becomes a set of lofty ideals that we buy into every time we purchase that $6 bottle of asparagus water. That kind of branding is good not only for Whole Foods, but for television. Here, the meta commentary gets pretty explicit again. People shower Craig and Tweak with money for being gay. The message is clear. The spectacle of inclusion is good for business. The episode ends with a crowd of voyeurs watching Craig and Tweak through a window, raising the question of whether the affirmation is for them or for the viewer. In the new neoliberal economy, the spectacle of inclusion is sold just like any other commodity. We fork over some cash, and in return, we get a healthy dose of self-righteousness. Slovenian theorist and curmudgeonly mountain troll Slavoj Žižek thinks that modern political systems can be much more dangerous than they were in the days of yore because they're just so dang pleasant. In the face of dictators, bad bosses, or the KKK, it's easy to point a finger and say, hey, that's the bad guy. Fuck him. In other words, this,
and then after we fucked every last one of them to death, we build a big wall,
is easier to hate than this.
Hello, ladies. Thanks for coming to our event.
Hi.
We're just tired of the way people with disabilities get treated. Can I get you some alcohol?
Being a PC bro is still about getting laid and wasted, but now they have a pleasant facade to hide their real motivations.
I've joined a social awareness group.
Žižek describes political correctness as just a form of self-discipline which doesn't really allow you to overcome racism, misogyny, and so on. If PC culture is dangerous, it's because it's just a nice paint job over the same old discriminatory reality.
We'll keep the existing structures but add brick walkways and some quaint white lights.
There's no longer a clear villain to rally against, just self-satisfying acts of social justice. The new progressive world of South Park is one where people regularly blow hundreds of dollars at Whole Foods but are expected to feel good because they donated $1 to charity. Never mind the wasteful excess of your grocery list, you can wash yourself of the guilt with a token gesture of charity.
$26 in filet mignons and $1 for hungry kids around the world.
On the one hand, we have those who criticize neoliberalism but don't actually do anything about it. On the other, we have those who actively oppose it. Žižek argues that this kind of Whole Foods-style charity is the perfect marriage between these two camps, between inaction and action. You don't actually have to change the world. Change and rebellion become another commodity. Criticism is perfectly disarmed because you can be a good neoliberal consumer and still feel like you're fighting against it. Žižek argues that rebelling against the system is tolerated, even promoted, so long as it stays within the acceptable bounds. He uses the term interpassivity, which denotes the practice of doing things not in order to achieve something. Political correctness, he says, fits the formula of let's go on changing something all the time so that globally things will remain the same. Of course, South Park attacks the very heart of this hypocrisy.
Spare a dollar? No, I don't. I'm sorry. Thank you. God damn it, ew.
The town's real feelings about the poor are brought to light when Whole Foods gets surrounded by the homeless.
I didn't bust my ass to gentrify this part of town to have it overrun with homeless people.
It's not just economic hypocrisy that South Park targets. Multiculturalism becomes a kind of badge to wear, to buy into, rather than a real political project.
What do you want? Now look, not all cops are racist, trigger-happy assholes.
Really?
I'll bet you don't even know what farm-to-table means.
The denizens of South Park are still just as ignorant, but now know the benefits of feigning knowledge of other cultures.
You know, a lot of people think that Asians decide who's gay and who's not. But it isn't all Asians. It's just specifically the Japanese, okay?
You sure know a lot about this.
Yes, I do.
The show is criticizing the individual just as much as they're calling out other shows. The meta-criticism raises the question, does token inclusion really make for more inclusivity? Or is it a shell of actual diversity that is meant to boost ratings rather than understand another culture?
That is whack!
In the end, this show of tolerance is more about making white liberals feel good than the marginalized people they seek to help.
You know, there's still some people out there that say, what does being PC really mean? Well, I'll tell you what it means. It means you love nothing more than beer, working out, and that feeling you get when you rhetorically defend a marginalized community from systems of oppression.
The PC frat house, for all the talk about marginalized people of color, is, well, entirely white. Even their fervent passion to help the disabled is just a cover to crush puss. French philosopher Jean Baudrillard uses the term charity cannibalism to denote the process whereby other people's destitution becomes our adventure playground, where we continually seek to secure the conditions of reproduction of the catastrophe market. According to Baudrillard, when we run out of tragedies to feel bad about, we start inventing our own.
Why would a person with a disability not see that what I'm trying to do is actually protect them?
Sometimes victims of oppression are so marginalized that they begin to sympathize with their oppressors.
Yeah, bruh.
When PC Principal encounters a marginalized person, Jimmy, who doesn't want his help, he finds Nathan, who more aptly suits his narrative of the world. Nathan plays the role of a helpless victim whose feelings of outrage reflect PC Principal's.
Could you tell Jimmy how you feel when people use the word retarded?
It hurts my feelings because I feel bad.
Are you serious right now?
The point is not that using the word retarded is okay because someone with a disability uses it. It's that this relation of protector-victim is always disempowering to the victim, who will only be validated by virtue of their helplessness. This is why Zizek would argue this sort of PC culture is more intolerant to other cultures. We lovingly accept everyone so long as we can pigeonhole them into a type of difference we can consume. Never mind that Caitlyn Jenner, who is of course a stunning and brave hero, was accused of killing a person. And is critical of gay marriage.
It's always been a man and a woman.
It's much easier to congratulate ourselves as a society by plastering her on Vanity Fair. It's simple, it's consumable, it sells. Part 2, Safe Spaces and Narcissism. I should probably clarify here that people throw around the term political correctness and safe space in an entirely vague and not very helpful way. On the one end, you have some guy for whom every social interaction resembles a 12-year-old who just learned the N-word on Xbox Live.
There's only one immigration policy that I believe in, and that's fuck 'em all to death!
On the other end, you have people who confuse social justice for wanting to live in a bubble where nothing bad happens and terrible things like slavery never existed. These people on both sides are few and far between, so please stop freaking out. South Park reliably takes down both sides of the political extreme, making fun of both Trump-esque conservatism,
fuck them all to death, let's make this country great again,
and, well, everyone who got a liberal arts degree.
I'm sorry, the world isn't one big liberal arts college campus.
What the show is really saying is that behind both sides, there lies a deep-rooted narcissism. As we've already discussed, a lot of buying into the PC brand is more about making yourself feel good than affecting real change. The Whole Foods donation arc ends with Randy morphing a charity about feeding hungry kids, or sending hamsters to college or whatever, into a charity where kids in the developing world are given iPads to protect the fragile egos of people like Randy.
For just $1 a day, one of these beautiful children will protect you from trolls and make your internet a safe space.
And that's what this Whole Foods activism is about, being a sellout to the system while making meaningless gestures to protect your own sense of self-worth. Then there's Cartman, who we've known for years is a terrible monster, yet suddenly adopts PC culture. But we also know he's a pathological liar and raging narcissist, so it makes sense that he'd use safe space language to protect his ego. On the other side of things, we have Mr. Garrison and his fuck 'em all to death attitude. His version of American exceptionalism is more or less the nationalist version of the special snowflake complex. Convinced that America's unique greatness is being ruined by Canadians, he tries to build a wall to protect America. What is his shock to the Canadian wall being put up first to keep him out, but the realization that he's not the center of the universe?
Now, goddammit, let me see!
In other words, Cartman, Steven Seagal, and Garrison supporters are fueled by a narcissistic obsession with themselves.
I suppose you're all feeling pretty good about yourselves.
Here's where neoliberalism enters the picture again. Neoliberalism promotes a culture of consumerism centered on the individual, and nothing quite fuels the economy like self-obsession in mass.
Every person here thinks this is about them.
What is left is a cult of victimhood. For Mr. Garrison, you have the paranoid delusion that everyone's out to ruin your way of life and steal your job.
Hey, Tinkerjim!
Hey, Tinkerjim!
For the show's PC crowd, it's the mistaken idea that not being a victim of harassment means someone entertaining your illusions of grandeur. For those already privileged, it means aspiring to victimhood.
We're the victims now!
In the end, everyone wants to hang reality. The point is not that everyone advocating for safe spaces, or everyone who loves their country, is one of these extreme caricatures, but that otherwise reasonable logic has been caught up in a whirlwind of societal bullshit. Conclusion. The creators of South Park probably don't hate every aspect of PC culture, but the shallow versions of it propagated in the mainstream media.
Your species took PC and twisted it for evil purposes.
After all, PC Principal has a sort of redemption. After learning he's been manipulated by ads, he goes on a rampage, murdering all the inauthentic PC bros. Creators Matt Stone and Trey Parker are also acutely aware of their own privileged position, nodding to this in the show.
We're two privileged straight white boys who have their laughs about things we never had to deal with.
And the finale makes it explicit that PC Principal is here to stay, with Stan commenting,
"This is gonna be really hard."
Because, well, it is. Not wanting to seem like a bigot while avoiding the trappings of phony inclusion is really hard.
Caitlyn Jenner is a hero. There's no other way to say it, and she is absolutely stunning.
With season 20 around the corner, what will happen? Will the show yield to the pressures of a changing society and reorient itself completely?
We cannot let them take from us our PC.
Or will they stick their middle finger firmly in the air and double down on their off-color roots?
Send in the pregnant Mexican women. Fire the taco launchers. Syrian refugee children flank from the left. Send in Jared.
South Park has to navigate our current political climate, whether they like it or not.
And on that note, let's take another break to listen to another public service announcement. How very noble of us.
Would you like to get updates on your smartphone in an emergency, even if a cell tower is down? It is possible if the FM chip is activated in your phone. Visit freeradioonmyphone.ca to see how you can get involved by contacting your carrier and signing our petition.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on CITR 101.9 FM, the Rick and Morty-approved skeptical broadcast. And we're back. From culture, i.e. South Park, to pure science. Well, pure animated science. Let's delve into philosophy upon my favorite show, Rick and Morty. This will be good.
Today, we're talking about one of the best shows on TV right now, and a personal favorite, Rick and Morty. We know you're probably jonesing for some new episodes after the year and a half wait was announced.
Tune in to Rick and Morty Season 3 in like a year and a half.
So, we wanted to hold you over with an analysis of Rick and Morty so far. The philosophy, the science, and everything you missed while you were laughing at the dick jokes.
Lick, lick, lick my balls! Yeah!
Rick and Morty chronicles the exploits of a mad scientist and his naive grandson as they go on deeply irresponsible and awesome space adventures. It's more or less the plot of Back to the Future, but Doc is a gassy alcoholic.
I agree, Morty!
Morty never tries to hit on his mom, and the duo travels through alternate dimensions rather than time. Rick and Morty is deeply rooted in the traditions of sci-fi horror, often paying homage to things like Ghostbusters, filmmaker David Cronenberg.
Boy, Morty, I really Cronenberged the world up, didn't I?
Nosferatu, and Freddy Krueger to name a few.
Looks like some sort of legally safe knockoff of an 80s horror character with miniature swords for fingers instead of knives.
The show even references Zardoz, a camp classic and guilty pleasure of mine. Nowhere else will you get to see Sean Connery in a futuristic space thong, but seriously, see the movie, it's actually really smart. While the show pays homage to a wide spectrum of sci-fi and horror, it has an affinity for a particular sci-fi tradition, cosmic horror. Pioneered by literary horror legend H.P. Lovecraft, the cosmic horror genre emphasizes the terror of that which is outside our grasp to comprehend. Like Lovecraft, Rick and Morty uses the cosmos as a way to explore deep philosophical questions by imagining what lies hidden in the black depths of space. The show opening even makes a visual reference to Lovecraft's Cthulhu. Cosmic horror goes way beyond just cheap jump scares. It presents us with the vast unknown and unimaginable, that simultaneous feeling of fright, disgust, and dread that we feel as whatever lurks in incomprehensible space suddenly comes crashing into our own reality. Rick's portal gun is constantly confronting us with this unknown. As he jumps headfirst into other realities, the results are sometimes horrifying, sometimes hilarious, and sometimes both. Occasionally, that reality comes to us, particularly in the episode Get Swifty. Earth is approached by a giant spacehead whose sheer gravitational mass causes mayhem on Earth's ecosystem. The giant head commands the entirety of Earth to show him what they've got.
Show me what you got!
A cult soon develops to worship this cosmic entity, and Rick, realizing the head is a Cromulan, informs the president that they have to come up with a hit song and win the intergalactic equivalent of America's Got Talent.
It's Swifty time today!
Or be disintegrated by a giant space laser. Giant, floating, cosmic entities aren't anything new in the science fiction universe. Our old friend H.P. Lovecraft used the idea constantly, developing a race of great old ones who he describes in books like Call of Cthulhu and the Dunwich Horror. There are a few interesting questions that big floating scary things bring up. First, cosmic horror begs the question, are we significant? Most science fiction is convinced that humanity is, metaphorically, the center of the universe, whether we're battling the Empire or trying to get all the aliens to just be friends. Humanity, or things that look like humanity, takes center stage. Cosmic horror inverts that premise and asks the question, what if the universe doesn't give a shit about us? For the Cromulans, humanity is merely an object of entertainment. Annihilating a planet is not an act of spite or a cause for concern. It's just something you do.
There's one every season.
Cosmic horror is full of these giant entities that demonstrate just how insignificant humanity actually is. And that's what is really terrifying, or in the case of Rick and Morty, kind of hilarious in a dark, dark way. In the book, In the Dust of This Planet, contemporary American philosopher Eugene Thacker describes this cosmic pessimism prevalent in the horror genre that imagines a world without us, and thinks through the universe as absolutely unhuman and indifferent to the hopes, desires, and struggles of human individuals and groups. The show embodies this cosmic pessimism almost perfectly. Rick and Morty even die, only to be replaced by one of the infinite other versions of themselves in an alternate reality. Not only are we but a speck of dust on a tiny blue marble in the cosmos at large, we're also like one of an infinite amount of the exact same speck of dust.
There's an infinite number of realities, Morty.
Rick and Morty doesn't want us to be terrified of our own insignificance. It wants us to laugh at it. Even though we are but specks of dust to these cosmic horrors, we too are the cosmic horrors to other specks of dust. In The Ricks Must Be Crazy, we learn that Rick's car battery is powered by a micro-universe whose sole purpose is to perform an inane task, produce energy. And in that universe, they invent another mini-universe. And so on and so on. Rick might as well be one of Lovecraft's cosmic deities to the denizens of the microverses. It's like cosmic Inception, brah!
It's like Inception, Morty!
In a multiverse beyond our comprehension, with infinite possibilities, values and meanings start to slip away.
What about the reality where Hitler cured cancer, Morty? The answer is don't think about it.
All that can remain is pessimism.
Oh my god, no!
Which brings us to our next section on the existentialism of Rick and Morty. Rick and Morty addresses the question of our very existence in almost every single episode.
Don't think about it!
Existence is pain to a meeseeks, Jerry!
Nobody exists on purpose. Nobody belongs anywhere. Everybody's gonna die.
On the one hand, we have the cosmic insignificance of humanity as a whole, and on the other, we have the frivolity of individual human life.
That's my grave.
The show offers us two examples of how to respond to our pathetic existence through Rick and Jerry. First, we have Jerry, who is seemingly oblivious to the soul-crushing mediocrity and pointlessness of his own life. He is literally more happy in a poor simulation of the world than his actual life.
I am finally complete.
Or as Arthur Schopenhauer might well have described Jerry's life, the life of every individual viewed as a whole and in general, and when only its most significant features are emphasized, is really a tragedy. But gone through in detail, it has the character of a comedy. Jerry is a failure. He's unemployed, his wife hates him, and he's not exactly the sharpest tool in the shed. But one can argue that Jerry is better off than the belligerently drunk Rick, because he's simply too dumb to realize that his life is pointless. But in this ignorance, Jerry seems content toiling away for the sake of nothing.
Life is effort and I'll stop when I die!
Then there's Rick, who understands the meaninglessness of life and accepts it. But despite Rick's sarcasm and nonchalant attitude towards pain and suffering,
hold your breath!
Hey, what the hell, Rick?
He's also an alcoholic whose catchphrase means, I'm in great pain.
Wubba lubba dub dub!
Do you know what wubba lubba dub dub means? It means, I am in great pain. Please help me.
The pure rationalism of the universe furthers the feeling of insignificance of our own lives. We're left with a paradox. Science allows us to make some sort of sense of the universe through formulas and theorems, but we as humans are left confronting the bleak, arbitrary nature of our own existence.
Yes, I'd like to order one large sofa chair with extra chair, please.
High chair. No, recliner.
Science can reason away any sense of sanctity or emotion and turn the human experience into something meaningless. Rick takes time out of avoiding his own pending death to explain, mathematically, that Summer and Morty are both pieces of shit. Rick goes on to rationalize away his feelings for Morty, explaining that their bond is only an easy way to hide Rick's genius brainwaves.
You're as dumb as I am smart!
From the intergalactic Popo. In another episode, Morty, as Roy, grows up and dies in a video game. After losing, he briefly forgets his own existence.
Where's my wife?
Morty, you were just playing a game.
The audience is left to question what exactly separates the fake reality of the Roy game to his own existence. After all, if Morty remembers his fake life and experiences all the emotions and sensations that constitute our own consciousness, what's the difference? Rick and Morty is constantly playing with this dichotomy between meaningless simulations and our actual life.
Holy crap!
If we recoil from the idea of living a fake life inside a video game, it's because we ascribe some meaning to the authenticity of our own waking life. But Rick and Morty is quick to display for all that that is a giant crock of shit.
No! I wanna be with Gary!
What's the difference between killing the memory parasites, whom the family feels genuine emotion for, and shooting, say, Mr. Poopy Butthole? This crisis of values, of our own meaning in life, is taken up by tons of existentialists, but our old friend Friedrich Nietzsche is particularly helpful here. Nietzsche tells the parable of the madman who comes into town screaming, "God is dead and we have killed him." Now, what Nietzsche was really trying to say is that after the Enlightenment and the Scientific Revolution, the big being in the sky that gave value to our lives was no longer relevant. After the death of God and philosophy, what remains is nihilism, a void of meaning.
My life has been a lie! God is dead! The government's lame! Thanksgiving is about killing Indians!
This struggle over the lack of meaning is what defines Rick Sanchez. Rick uses science to demystify everything.
Does evil exist? And if so, can one detect and measure it? Rhetorical question, Morty. The answer's yes, you just have to be a genius.
Love is just a set of chemical reactions.
What people call love is just a chemical reaction that compels animals to breed.
He even beats the devil, and in a way, actively plays out the death of God.
Yes! F*** you, God! Yes, I did it! There is no God in your face!
We're constantly left wondering, what does Rick care about, if anything at all? Rick's character embodies a tension between a kind of active and passive nihilism. The passive nihilist for Nietzsche is resigned to the hopelessness and meaninglessness of life. The active nihilist, however, actively seeks to destroy the old values and start anew.
Well, scientifically, traditions are an idiot thing.
A bomb!
We're gonna drop it down there and get a whole fresh start.
It's clear that something makes Rick tick, we're just not sure what. After all, he's labeled as an intergalactic terrorist fighting for something, and eventually, he gives himself up to save his family. Rick's actions may seem paradoxical, if only because he himself is struggling to make meaning out of the universe. The show also does its part to interrogate our own sense of morality, refusing to draw clear lines between right and wrong or good and evil.
I will kill anyone, anywhere. I just love killing.
Morty's attempts to be a do-gooder are always thwarted. After freeing a group of people from the body-snatching unity, a nipple-driven race war commences between the now freed rabble of pedophiles and prostitutes. When confronted with the grim consequences, Summer aptly replies,
"I didn't know freedom meant people doing stuff that sucks."
Herein lies another existential question. What is biological life without living?
Listen, Unity, I don't think my sister's trying to say that life would be perfect without you. I think she's just saying that life would be, you know, life.
If we, the audience, are repulsed by the thought of body snatchers, the show also makes us consider the fact that our irrational attachment to freedom is what allows us to live in a world that is oh so terribly fucked up. Another way to look at the existential question in Rick and Morty is through the work of Albert Camus, specifically in Me Seeks and Destroy.
I can't take it anymore! I just wanna die! We all wanna die! We're Me Seeks!
The central tenet of Camus' absurdism is that life consists of two irreconcilable facets, the human tendency to find meaning in life, and the universe's complete indifference to our existence. In Rick and Morty, we see the opposite of this in the Meeseeks.
Meeseeks are not born into this world, fumbling for meaning, Jerry! We are created to serve a singular purpose for which we will go to any lengths to fulfill!
For Camus, human life was exactly the opposite, as illustrated in the myth of Sisyphus, the king who was sentenced to spend an eternity pushing a boulder up a hill, only for it to fall back down upon completion, over and over again. Or for Jerry, it's not a boulder, but his golf swing. And then there's this.
Earth Rick C-137, the Council of Rick sentences you to the machine of unspeakable doom, which swaps your conscious and unconscious minds, rendering your fantasies pointless while everything you've known becomes impossible to grasp.
Many characters in the show, rather than seek meaning for their own existence, simply resent their creators for bringing them into this world.
I didn't ask to be born!
We see this Frankenstein complex not only in the Meeseeks.
He wrote me into this!
Well, that one over there wrote me into this!
Well, he wrote me into this!
But put in Aberdolf Linkler.
You brought me into this world, a suffering abomination, tortured by the duality of its being. But I shall finally know peace when I watch the life drain from your wretched body!
Morty Jr., and of course, Frankenstein's monster himself, makes an appearance. For Camus, we are perpetually frustrated by our floundering attempt to find meaning and purpose in life, and our inability to do so. He offers, as an alternative, to embrace the emptiness of the absurd. Or as Rick says,
"The answer is don't think about it."
Or to quote Morty,
"Nobody exists on purpose. Nobody belongs anywhere. Everybody's gonna die. Come watch TV."
The fictional and sometimes almost real science of Rick and Morty allows us to explore all the ways that, despite our love for Rick, our lives are as sad and pathetic as Jerry's.
Oh, Jerry.
But the science in the show also works as an excuse for some really nerdy jokes.
Our time's gonna need a little time to, you know, stabilize.
Some are obvious, like the entire episode loosely based off the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. This principle from quantum mechanics, pioneered by a notable meth dealer, states that it is impossible to know both the location and momentum of a particle. That's because the tiny objects that make up our universe are at the same time waves and particles. If that's confusing, it's because it is. Rick and Morty draws humor from a superficial reading of science here, claiming that this uncertainty of quantum mechanics can cause our own realities to split. Outside, a sea of Schrödinger's cats are floating around, a reference to the 1935 thought experiment by Erwin Schrödinger. It ponders, in a quantum world where particles can be two things at once, is it possible for a cat rigged with an elaborate quantum booby trap to be both alive and dead at the same time? Because Austrians have dark, dark imaginations. This tenuous relationship to scientific truth could be viewed as a jab at the science fiction genre for constantly inventing scientific mumbo-jumbo to justify unlikely plot points.
Midichlorians are a microscopic life form that resides within all living cells.
Like stupid and smart brainwaves canceling each other out. In another episode, Rick is seen traversing tiny climates on a tiny planet, which is not at all how that works. In the same episode, the show's creators poke fun at the trust we place in TV narratives by making a joke about forced perspective.
I thought it was further away.
The show also exhibits a unique kind of atheism that constantly invalidates religious figures by boiling them down to pure science.
All previous existing religions. I'm going out onto the sidewalk, I'm dropping to my knees and pledging my eternal soul to the thing that literally controls the f***ing weather.
It also acknowledges the frequent misuse of science by those with religious agendas.
You can't kill the truth, Father!
In Something Wicked This Way Comes, Jerry's personal interpretation of science leads him on a crusade to reinstate Pluto's planethood. He is greeted by the Plutonians, who have not-so-subtle crosses in their eyes, drawing a comparison to religious fundamentals. Of course, it's all a ploy to manipulate Plutonians into thinking the destruction of their planet by their corporate overlords is totally not a big deal. So, to pull it all together, Rick and Morty is a show that holds nothing as sacred. By exploring the absurdities of a purely rational universe and pushing the boundaries of decency in a sci-fi horror setting, we get to ask all sorts of fun, depressing questions like, why am I here? And what's the point of it all? We're not really sure where the show will go with Rick's character. Will he finally do something for the greater good? Or is his latest move just another bleak, self-serving ploy? As always, thanks for watching. Wubba lubba dub dub!
Well, that's all the time we have this week, and this is Dawn saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose, a morning flower.